session number 9938, reel 3.
Mr. Philpott, reel 3. Right.
Tommy Thompson had dropped his bombs on this U-boat, and weren't there more bombs to drop? And he could see that the U-boat staying on the surface, which is, of course, an insane thing for a U-boat to do. And he realized it had been damaged and couldn't dive. And so he shot his machine gun. He fired his machine guns. He got some front guns and from his turret. I think he had front guns. He certainly had turret guns. And he fired his machine guns at this U-boat floundering around on the surface, whereupon the U-boat commander went down below and ferreted round in his locker and took his white dress shirt and emerged on the bridge of the U-boat waving his white dress shirt, meaning surrender. And of course Tommy had got through to the control room back at Wick and notified them of this event very fast and called for destroyers fast. And he circled around making menacing gestures, this U-boat. He couldn't really do much with it. And eventually destroyers came and captured the U-boat. And the U-boat was converted to British colors and a British name and served the British cause, which is very handy. In 42 Squadron, we were nothing if not versatile. We went in for instance, endless patrols. They seemed endless, particularly for a SPROG pilot, a beginner pilot, which I was in the squadron. And you went droning out across the sea looking for U-boats all the time because Britain was very, very nearly starved of supplies, and one trembled to think what would happen if the supply ships didn't come in from America and other sources with food and so on, because we would just have been starved out, and we all knew it. And the sinking figures were terrible, which were publicized. They were absolutely terrible. The patrols weren't dangerous, except one had to be very careful in bad weather not to run into mountains, like the pilot of an aircraft taking the Duke of Kent was to do, which is a very sad affair. And one always had an uneasy feeling about the engines, because there was something wrong with the Taurus engines. This a thing called a manaton, M-A-N-A-T-O-N, bolt, attaching the big end, I think it was the big end, would suddenly go in one engine, and no matter what the ground crews, who were pretty good, and the engineering staff amongst them did in the way of inspection, they could never guarantee that one of these manaton bolts wouldn't give way. In which case the engine just stopped, and you've got the troubles I've illustrated already. For instance, I used to do a thing called the Fair Patrol, going up and down Fair Island, off Fair Island, and looking out for U-boats, and keeping well clear of Scarpa Flow, because the British Navy would fire at anything flying at all. They might ask questions as to what sort of airplane, whose airplane was to start with, but they were guarding the British fleet, so we kept clear of our own British fleet. And I went out on one of my first trips to Norway, which one was graduating towards doing, in what was called a SA Patrol 1A, and then there's another one more or less, not parallel, but radiating out in that direction towards Norway, SA 1B, SA 1C patrols, and I was on the SA 1A. The name was always rather touching, because it was really based, called the Spanish Armada Patrol. You could see the defensive mentality that we want to get at anybody getting at these shores. And I went out in my first SA-1A patrol, led by one Passmore, who was a magnificent experienced pilot in his famous F for Freddy, which he was brilliant at piloting in attack peak and going in for operations on. When I looked around, and the man on the left who had come with us, Sergeant Turner, I saw sagging down towards the beach off Lucas. We'd moved down to Lucas by then. And I was told by my tail gunner that he was seen landing and a crash landing on the beach there. And it turned out later his one engine, his Manaton bolt in one engine had gone. That was the sort of thing that happened now and again. You could never predict it. So you're always watching. One also did patrols occasionally up as far as the Faroes, which in those days is a fairish distance, and one got a bit lonely out there. Then the Beaufort could be used and was used also for bombing. This is rather a crude business because we got no real training over bombing land as to what height to go in at and that sort of thing. And I was set off on my first bombing trip to Christian Sand in the night.
Before we go on to that, could you tell me about the degree of contact one would have with the enemy on your patrols?
Yes, the degree of contact with the enemy was minimal. And it was a surprising thing to come across him on these patrol activities. One occasionally did and saw an aircraft in the distance and so on. No, the thing we were watching for mostly, we were fighting, was the weather as much as anything. And avoiding running into bits of Scotland or the outlying islands of Scotland, off Scotland. And I was saying we did a little land bombing, and I was out on a trip which we did in quarter of an hour intervals, which was the thing not to do. Classic bad staff work by headquarters, 18 group there, send us out one, and then quarter of an hour later to bomb Christian Sand Aerodrome right down in the south of Norway there.
You mean it was bad because of the regularity of the interval?
Yes, it was predictable and very, very much the wrong height. I think we bombed from, might have been 7,500 feet, which is absolutely lethal, really. Either should have gone in low with suitable bombs or we could stagger up to a bigger height.
Did you realize that at the time?
Oh, yes. Yes, but you just did these things. And One went across there. It was a brilliant moonlit night, and one felt very naked. One had to go over Norway. One had to go over a chunk of Norway before one got to Christian Sand. And of course, it was Norway where we always understood, and understood later, I think, that Hitler was more or less convinced we would attack. Well, we'd had one shocking affair being ashore in Norway and so on and so forth, and had to come out of it. And it was the last thing our high commander would ever do. But so he had a fair amount of fighters there and anti-aircraft things. Anyway, we came over Christian Sand, and I was told I got to do a dive bombing thing there. We hadn't got any dive bombing flaps, so We didn't feel really equipped for all this, because with a Beaufort, once you put that aircraft down, it just got faster and faster and faster. Very difficult to slow up and bring up again. And I thought it was all too quiet, really. I'd not had any fighters on my tail, and Norway looked very peaceful, like a bit of the moon or something. And you can see the water gleaming in the fjords and so on, and Christian Sand Fjord. And then suddenly there was absolute firework display just in front of my nose of the flak, the anti-aircraft stuff, coming up with right there, just like a firework. And I realized they'd got it wrong. They'd fired in front of me. And there's no future in going on like that, so I did a diving turn to the left, but not before there was a nasty thud, and my navigator next to me, called Sergeant Tillon, just fell forward, and that was the last movement he ever made. He was killed. And so we came down, and I did a big circle and came down over Kristiansand Aerodrome, and pressed. I got a 1,000-pound bomb and a couple of 500s, and dropped them as near as I could on the aerodrome. The report later came back, whether it was me or one of the others, I never quite discovered that 97 of the Luftwaffe were damaged that night, and a number of that were killed. So we did something. And then I realized the aircraft had been badly smashed up, but not so that it wouldn't fly. I screamed out of the place along Kristiansand Fjord, and debated with myself whether to land in Sweden on the left to the east in a nice lake there, and get wanted to be free there, or have a go at Britain. So as the aircraft seemed to be flying all right, I had a go and get back to Britain, and went out the mouth of Kristiansand Fjord and headed west with unknown damage, but we got petrol, that I knew. And then the air gunner came up and stood by the hatch by my right shoulder and staggered there, and he's holding his arm, and he said, "I've been wounded, sir," and he looked bloody awful. And so I told the air gunner, who was a man with experience in India and so on, called West, he was not damaged, and I told him to look after Sergeant Grant, the wireless operator, and lay him down and leave the door open in case we came down, and leave the hatch open so that he could be heaved into a dinghy, into our dinghy, provided the dinghy hadn't been hit, which is quite possible. And anyway, a long, long story there, and we groaned out across the... Norway never seemed to disappear. The cliffs on my right were there. What I wanted to do was to get out in the sea and away from this hostile coastline. And the compass was hit, and we were in various trouble, and I hadn't got a navigator, and so on, so on. The wireless had been smashed up. We didn't know whether they got a message or not, and it turned out they got a confused message but couldn't make head or tail of it. And to cut a long story short, we droned our way for 4 hours into the dawn with a dead man beside me and a wounded man further back, and landed eventually at Northcotes in Lincolnshire with no undercarriage. We had to do a crash landing.
What date would this have been, approximately?
That was 19... I think it was about June the 10th, and 1941. Yes, 1941. And they handed out 3 decorations to us and so on, and eventually I got back to Lucas, and flew myself back there, because you've got to keep flying, you know, when something like this happens to you. And they actually mended the aircraft, and it went flying again in due course, which was something. Then that was an attempted bombing. Then there was torpedoing, which is what we were there for, really, to torpedo ships. And I went out in one of these patrols, the Spanish Armada Control, off the coast of Norway on what's called a rover patrol in the moonlight, wandering along the coast there at nil feet, you know, about 60 feet above the sea, something like that. And suddenly I saw a ship up a little field there, somewhere near, I think, Egersund. And I shouted out, attack, attack, and went towards it and got up to the proper height. And to drop a torpedo, I think it was from 140 feet you had to be. If you went higher than that, the torpedo would bounce about and twist and turn. If you went lower than that, it would just skid along the surface and not dive, so we were told. And you had to drop a torpedo strictly straight, the aircraft held straight and level, at a reduced speed, which is about 140 knots, whereas really in those parts, if you're near the enemy, you want to go your maximum, about 210 knots, which would be no good for the operation. Anyway, I approached this ship, and again, it was all too quiet. And so I didn't wait for the fireworks or the flak coming up. I turned left and then wrenched it round to the right again, coming in at a slightly different angle, hoping they'd fix their guns towards where I was, firstly. And so it turned out. They shot more or less beside me on the right, missed me, and I was able to drop the torpedo at this little ship, carefully avoiding hitting the mast. You've got all sorts of worries in anything like this. I was credited with a hit at the time, but I'm not sure it was credited after the war. I never verified that.
Why didn't you want to hit the mast?
Well, you can't run into the mast anymore. You can run a car into a telephone pole. The mast of the ship, it just looms up. The mast of a ship is really...
So you didn't run the plane into the mast?
Yes, I'm sorry. I didn't make that clear. Yes, that's right. These sort of worries one had all the time. And then I turned away and got out of the place as quickly as possible and headed back. And later, when I tried to get the the flaps down, the wheels were all right this time, but the flaps down to slow up for the landing and so on back at Lucas, the flaps didn't work, so one had to do a rather fast landing and notify and indicate to the people in the aerodrome that you were in a bit of trouble, which we did. And later I found that our rudder wire strands were two-thirds shot away, so we nearly lost rudder control, which is really quite important in doing these swift turns in a funny little field like that. So one was lucky.
Again, what was the date of this approximately?
That was that would have been about May 41, about May 41, round about there. And then I was saying the different pastimes, the different operations of 42 Squadron, for instance, mine laying at night. There was a place called Haugesund, where the ships used to come in, the German ships working up the Norwegian coast, they holding Norway and wanting to keep it fortified and so on, would go through a narrow gap between an island and the mainland of Norway there, and we were told to go out and drop mines there. Six of us went out on a moonlit night. There's actually rather bad weather and so on. And I remember approaching the place, and I knew I was being fired on, in this case, because I ran through the smell of of anti-aircraft fire. You can smell it sometimes. And it is quite difficult to spot where you were. The clouds came up and so on. I was mighty glad of Murray's blind flying lessons he gave to me in the Oxford University Air Squadron. Really, really saved me and then my crew and everybody, because one is confident with this in the real event. Flight Sergeant Heron, I remember, had gone over there, who was a very daring pilot of 42. He'd gone over there on this trip, which he, as he'd done in other ones, with a lot of empty beer bottles. He had an idea if you threw them over the side, they'd make a horrible noise and put off the anti-aircraft gunners, which is a fanciful sort of thing, but anyway, nobody stopped him. And he actually didn't come back from that, and two out of the six didn't. I found myself over Haugesund, intense fire coming up, and I streaked across over the houses and things there and found part of the waterway we were aiming to drop the mine at. And again, you had to go slowly with these things, slow everything up and be at a certain height and drop the mine. I think I dropped it in the wrong part of Haugesund, the north side, not the south, but it didn't matter really because the ships had to come through each. So that was mine dropping. And then I suppose the main operational thing that is much in my memory was the attack on the Lützow, L-U-T-Z-O-W, the Lützow, the ex-Deutschland pocket battleship, because if we could only sink those pocket battleships, there was the Graf Spee, which is dealt with on the far side of the world, there was the Admiral Scheer, which is always dodging about in the North Sea, and this Lützow was another one, and we're all sort of waiting for it. And 42 Squadron were alerted, streaked down to the aerodrome at Lucas on a night, and we got 12 squadrons, 12 aircraft, always torpedoes, already, and I remember being in the very rarely the squadron could mount 12 aircraft at once, but they did, and they had to. And I remember being in the operations room where the navigators are fiddling around with their maps and everything, and receiving last minute instructions, and then the operational controller suddenly waved his hand at us and stopped us all talking. And said, hand over the thing, said, Commander-in-Chief of Coastal on, Commander-in-Chief, yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir. And then he still held the phone there, and he said, the Commander-in-Chief is counting the minutes with his fingers for 42 Squadron to get airborne. And that made an impression on us, and we all scurried out and got in. And in some way, we managed to have four flights of three aircraft each in formation 1, 2, 3, 4. I was next to the commanding officer, Wing Commander Faville, who was on my left, and I had Sergeant Lovett on my Flight Sergeant Lovett on my right, chap from Coventry, and I had the most difficult flight I have ever had. I think one simply sweated all the way, because the great thing was to keep low, and it's night, and not fly into the sea, and keep it about 100 feet, and it was a cloudy night with patches of moon coming through, and then you'd get some cloud and rain and so on, And above all, you mustn't run into the CO, you mustn't run into Lovett, and Lovett's got to watch where you are and so on. And you've got to keep your wits about you all the time. And for a couple of hours, we went ahead like that. And then suddenly ran into a rain cloud, great thickness, and I couldn't see the adjoining aircraft, the adjacent aircraft. And when we got out of this low cloud, just above the surface of the sea, I looked ahead, and there was the commanding officer's tailplane just in front of me. I must have missed him by about, I don't know, 8 feet or something. So I dived away to the left quickly to avoid him, and there was nothing I could run into on the left. And then we all lost one another, because it really was a poor night. And I did not see the Lützow, which we were after. I wandered about all over there, and I tried a search, and it didn't work, and didn't see it at all. And eventually came back with my torpedo, which is not a very distinguished thing to do. And so did most of the others. Sergeant Lovett, however, got through, and there was the pocket battleship, as he recounted to us. He got through. There was the pocket battleship with a screen of five destroyers in front and on each side there. And he took his... They very obligingly fired a star shell for him right up in the air and lit up the whole scene, which a torpedo bomber pilot, he couldn't ask for more. You see what he's doing at night. Very, very, very convenient. And he slipped in across one of the destroyers, which were very slow in firing at him. Maybe they thought he was German. And he dropped his torpedo, and he hit the Lützow. He hit the Lützow. And when he came back, and we heard of all this, and the reconnaissance people had reported that the Lützow and its five destroyers had turned back to Germany, presumably Kiel or somewhere, And that was Sergeant Lovett, and he got an immediate Distinguished Flying Cross for that marvelous effort.
What would be the date of that? About
that was June or July 1941, around about then. And I've often thought, when I got back. I observed everything going on, I heard of what was going on. I've often thought that a pilot from 22 Squadron, which is operating from North Coast, down the coast there a bit south of us, called Eddie Culverwell, who had been reported as saying, we've got to get that. And he went out without any permission or orders or anything. From 22 Squadron, and his 22 Squadron Beaufort, to the Lützow, which by then, of course, was being highly protected by clouds of German fighters just circling around it and escorting it back home. And I think he went in, but I don't know. We had very good controllers of the operation rooms there, one called Johnny Hosh, H-O-C-H-E, and